Welcome to the Human Experience Podcast with Carl Sokia.
Aloha! And welcome to another episode of the Human Experience Podcast, featuring Carl Sokia. Now, in today's episode, I have one of my dearest friends that I've known for a long, long time, and I've been asking him to come onto the podcast. I'm grateful that he took time out of his busy day coaching football for Lone Peak High School, but I'm grateful to have my good friend Kyle Nelson here in the studio to talk a little bit about what it's like in his world. He's a teacher at Lone Peak, but also coaches sports, and I really want to tap into this whole idea behind working with centennials. The late, you can call them post-millennials, centennials, some people call them Generation Z. This younger generation, I really want to tap into Kyle and just say, what is it like? You know, what have you found as a really unique way to get through to them? And Kyle is such an exceptional teacher. He does such fun stuff in the classroom. There's a lot of videos that he's posted and you know, freestyle rapping, and you can see the engagement between him and these young people. And I want to kind of tap into that and get his advice on how we can really utilize that, not only in our businesses, but also in our homes with our own family. So my brother, number 80, welcome to the show, Kyle Nelson.
What's up, Carl, man? This is great.
Good to have you, brother, man.
I want to break from whatever type of format you have. Yeah. And I just want to be honest with everybody. This was Carl's second aloha. The first aloha is his voice cracked. And he thinks he can just play it off and like edit it out. But I just want you to know his voice cracked.
So it's funny because Kyle comes in and says, you know, I really like your aloha at the beginning of the episodes. So then when it cracked, he laughed. And I said, this stuff don't come for free, brother. You have to work for these alohas, man. This ain't easy.
Well, this is awesome. This is great. I love the setup.
Appreciate it.
I'm just glad I get to come see you. I haven't seen you forever.
Yeah, a long time.
We're growing apart, man. We're old. You have your kids. I have my kids.
Yeah.
You live in Sandy. I live in Lehigh.
I know.
It's good to see you.
I know. It's good to see you. Love you, brother. All so right. It's really nice, too, because Kyle and I grew up together. We went to high school together. Taylorsville, baby.
They call it Trailersville. Well, have you heard of I've never heard that before. People, right? They call it Trailersville.
I'm going to go ahead and edit that out because we don't use that kind of language on this podcast.
I was like, man, they're all rich up there. So
I'll put a little explicit note on this episode for that kind of trash up in my house. Oh, geez. So, I mean, back in Taylorsville days when we were there, we had a really cool squad going. Myself, Kyle, it was very diverse. You know, we had great friends. Trey, Truman, Stefan, Mike Malave. I mean, everybody.
Two Vietnamese kids, a Polynesian kid, a black kid, a couple white kids.
Will Zumwalt.
Oh, yeah.
The Shroom. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just, you know, we had such a diverse crew, and we've all, you know, definitely stayed in touch over the years. But, you know, one that took a really, you know, exciting path and really followed his passions was Kyle. You know, when we were younger, you know, one of the things that we loved to do is rap. Oh, my goodness. We loved. And do you remember there was a website that we used to go on?
Freestyle.
Was it freestyle.com?
Freestyle.com.
This is like right when the internet was starting to really get cool. Yes. And it was super slow to load. We would go on, and what would happen is you go on and you actually rap battle with other people. So you pre-put together this whole, like your bars, per se, and you go in and you start to battle against some random person that you don't know on the interwebs, and then they have X amount of time to respond to your rap. And then you can actually read these threads, I mean, threads and threads of all these people. And we loved it. We used to go on there all the time.
I was Ghostwriter. That was my pen name.
Ghostwriter.
Ghostwriter. Yeah, that's right. Right. Ghostwriter with a T.
That's right. And I was just like Carl.
I forgot all about this website. I'm glad you brought it up. I remember looking for it because I tried to find this old stuff that I wrote. And it was just gone. Everything's gone. But I like made, they had the top five like every like month. I made the top five one time, had Ghostwriter on there. I mean,
not
that
only
was
that,
like, that was one of my proudest moments.
Do you remember? It had the flames next to it.
Yes.
Do you remember that? It's like,
yes.
This is on fire.
Yes.
Oh, man. That was so much fun. But, you know, it was fun because we loved rap music. We loved hip hop. You know, we were big, huge Jurassic 5 fans. It's really funny. I have to tell you this story. My neighbor, shout out to Cole Wagstaff. We were driving down to Lehigh the other day and we're in the car and all of a sudden Jurassic 5 comes on my phone. And he goes, oh, you know J5? I was like, baby, do I know J5?
He's the original. Carl's the original. Turn me on to J5. Never heard about him. Jurassic 5.
Shout out to J5.
SIC.
That's funny. In fact, I told him, I said, I actually met a member of J5, Charlie Tuna, on my mission. I don't know if you know this.
Oh, yeah, Riverside.
And yeah, he's in a grocery store. Shout out to Charlie Tuna,
the verbal Herman Munster.
And it's funny because that's exactly what he said to me.
It's the angelic man, brother clan, repel them, my plan, parrot.
Yes.
But it's funny, I walked up to him and I had not heard this new album because I'm on my mission. And we walked up and I said, oh my gosh, you're Charlie Tune. He goes, it's the Verbal Herman Munster. And I was like, okay, well, I'm Elder Sokia. Nice to meet you. So funny. But yeah, we love J5. But getting back to the point, you know, I really think we loved grammar. We loved English. Those are things we loved, using our brains and intelligence to really try to communicate. You know, we loved, you know, unique ways of communicating. That's why we love Jurassic 5. You know, their freestyle flow is just so unique and it's so educated. The words they use, conjugate the verbs. I mean, they're so exciting. But Kyle kept going down that path. I mean, Kyle was very exceptional when it comes to grammar and English and literature and reading and also even an aspiring movie, you know, a movie producer. I mean, you know, we'd go back and try to make our own little home movies and all these fun things. That was really your craft. And, you know, Kyle got married very young, you know, quickly out of high school to his sweetheart, Rachel, who 20. We all love. Shout out to Rachel.
What's up, Rachel?
What up, Rach? And then he just kind of started going down this path while the rest of us knuckleheads were screwing around and going around and just doing knucklehead things. But he started to really get focused and say, well, I want to go down my road and become a teacher. So, Kyle, tell the group that is on this podcast a little bit about your background, kind of, you know, where you came from, you know, how you came up, and then kind of how you went down that path of where you're at today and when it really clicked that this is what you wanted to do in life.
All right. Never thought I'd become a teacher, that's for sure. Hated high school. Was a terrible student. 2.5 GPA, which some of you are like, oh, that's great. But
that's, my parents are like, Carl would kill yeah. for a 2.5.
I didn't get kicked out of any high schools like you, but I wasn't a good student. Didn't, you know, wasn't expected to go to college or anything like that. My mom, my dad didn't go to college. So it just kind of happened. Ended up going to Snow right out of high school just because a couple of friends went down there. Took a couple of, I think I started as a communications major because I thought, oh, I could talk. I could do that.
Yeah.
Then I switched to an English major because I took a couple of English classes that I really liked. Teacher that said, let's go have class outside today. I was like, okay, I'll fantastic. Be an English major now. So I'm going to change it. That's switched to an English major, didn't know what I was going to do with that. Thought I'd do something with writing. I like to write, was on the newspaper staff in high school.
That's right.
And a little bit in college. I got kicked off the one in high school. And then I got kicked off the one in college too. So I wasn't very good at it, but.
We're also doing a radio show in college too?
Also got kicked off of that. That was Jared's fault though. That wasn't my fault. We had just a few problems. I had a problem with authority, lots of problems with authority, which is funny because now I'm in a position of authority as a teacher, even though I don't really treat it that way. But
just waited to get kicked out of places. I did mine early. Yeah. I was an early adopter of this whole philosophy of yes. damn the man.
Yeah. When I was 20, I got married. It was super early. I'm coming up on my next year will be 20 year anniversary.
That's incredible, man. That's
crazy. So I get married at 20 and, you know, I got my first real job right around that time, which was at Utah Power. And I had this job from the time I was 20 till I was 28. It was like, that was kind of supposed to be the job I was supposed to stay at forever.
Right.
Good corporate, good company. My mom was proud of me, you know, that she thought this is where I was supposed to stay. Cause my mom, she worked at the phone company when she was younger and worked there till she retired. Yeah. And that's what you do. You get on with the company at an early age and you just stay there forever. And, you know, I didn't know I was 20 and started working there about 23. I'm looking around, I'm realizing this is not doing it for me.
Right.
Like I'm still kind of going to college slowly, just a class here or there. I didn't really know what I was going to do, but I just wasn't filling this job. Like it was not keeping me, I just didn't feel alive. And I saw people around me that were 40, 50, 60 years old. And I'm thinking, this isn't what I wanted. Like these guys just kind of clocking in, just waiting for the weekend, you know, no passion in their job. And like, I'm just like, man, I don't want this. And I felt like my soul was kind of dying a little bit inside. So, you know, as I continued taking classes, I took a sociology class at Salt Lake Community College of all places. And this teacher was like, I can't believe I get to do this for a living. We're just sitting around just talking about stuff and we're just having discussions. I can't believe they pay me for this. And I'm thinking, wow, yeah.
I can't believe they pay you either.
Yeah. I was like, well, yeah. You know, I was very just wanted, I'm very impressionable. You know,
sure.
I became an English major because one teacher took me outside and or took the class outside and I became a teacher, I think, because one teacher said, I can't believe we get to do this for a living. And I was like, that does sound fun to just sit and talk to young people all day. So
yeah.
I think that's when I kind of decided, and it was a slow roll for me to eventually graduate. Ended up getting my degree. Took me 11 years to get my bachelor's degree.
Sure.
So
I think I'm on year 23 or something.
Yeah. So There's the joke, the Tommy boy, you know, a lot of people take 7 years to get a degree, you know, they're called doctors or something. It's like, that's funny, but you know, it took me 11 years to get my degree. Cause I was, you know, raised in a family, married, right. had a couple
married
kids.
Young.
Yeah. And you know, plus I was working full time trying right. to take classes to fit my work schedule, which was really hard.
Yeah.
You know, they offer a class at 2:30 in the afternoon. It's like, how can I right. do this? I'm working, you know? Yep. So
absolutely
it took me forever, but finally, was able to, at 28 years old, got my degree, got a job as a teacher, and I've been teaching this my 12th year now.
It's
going
incredible.
Into my 12th year, and I love it. Teach English, creative writing. I coach football, and I feel like I'm living my dream.
I love it. So when you look at that, going in and starting to be a teacher, tell me about your experience when you started off, because I can't even imagine what it would be like to go in front of these young, impressionable people and go in and say, okay, now I'm going to start instilling knowledge, you know, to you, and get off your phone.
Yeah.
Okay. You know what I mean? And just trying to, number one, be confident enough to be able to educate them and share the, you know, the curriculum. And also I want to know a little behind the scenes peek. How exactly do you get all your curriculum? What's the freedom and the structure? I've always wondered that. Do they just slap down a book at the beginning of the year and it's like, here's the chapters you're going to teach, and it's pretty mindless.
Yeah.
Or is it kind of a free flowing deal? Because I don't know if a lot of people know that. It's kind of, we come to school. I had a teacher named Roy Budorf. Mr. Budorf,
oh my gosh.
That was a history teacher at Benyon Junior High in ninth grade, changed my life. He was incredible. And it's funny because I look at some of the grades I got in junior high. I got the best grades from the teachers I was super engaged with, which is funny. It wasn't what I was smart at and what I liked. That's who I was. I just didn't have a knack for really paying attention and the authority piece and so on.
Right.
But Roy Budorf, I'll tell you, I could get all D's or F's or not go to class or whatever. I got an A in his class. And I remember he taught us. He played One by Metallica and was teaching us all about the war and things like that. And I was like, this is incredible. Like, I was just so enamored. World history and giving us all these creative activities. And I was like, this is what I want to be a part of. And I thought the same thing. Like, I want to be a geography teacher for ninth graders because this is just so incredible. So how does that work? You know, tell me about going in, being a teacher, how it felt at the beginning and probably how it's evolved, but also how that curriculum is all set up.
Yeah, I mean, it's intimidating. It really is. I feel super comfortable now. I still get a little nervous though. Like at the beginning of the year, I'm like, oh, are these guys going to laugh at me? They're going to not think I'm funny? Are they, you know, are they going to like me?
Well, it probably evolves over the course of the year too,
definitely.
Right? Like you get that buy-in and then it's just clicking and then you're crying and you're hugging them and they leave and then it's like this new
start all over. The nice thing is being at the same school for so long, I'm teaching a lot of these kids, little brothers and sisters.
That's awesome.
You know, you have a reputation where they're like, oh, you got to get Nelson for this class or whatever teacher it is. And so it's cool because you get a little bit of buy-in from some kids initially. But it was scary. I think early on as a teacher, I was younger, which doesn't feel that young, but 28. And these kids were, you know, 18, 17. And I felt like, you know, I was maybe trying to be somebody I wasn't, you know.
Sure.
You get people saying things to young teachers like, don't smile till November, you know. Just get in there and just be a jerk and yell at them and show them who's boss. And then after they fear you, then they'll listen to you. And it's like, okay, I'm not going to smile until November.
And then they smile on Thursdays.
It's like, here I am taking a roll and I'm already making jokes and smiling. I'm like, ah, crap. August and I'm smiling.
Dang it.
But I totally reject that. And that's something I've learned is that you just have to be yourself. And, you know, I am not trying to be their friend, even though sometimes they think like, oh yeah, he's cool. He's one of us. You're not trying to be their friend, but you need them to like your class and like know that you care about them. And, you know, as you talk about, you know, how you felt about history in ninth grade or geography, I guess it's funny because you get so many kids that like, I hate science. It's like, you don't hate science. You hated that class.
Sure.
You know what I mean? You know, I hate English. Like, you don't hate English. You hated that one class or your last two teachers. You didn't like them.
Right.
And so the power that, you know, a teacher can have to help you like love a subject, it can get mixed up because it's like, well, wait, I really love this class, but I hate grammar. You know, it's like, where do I really like this subject or did I just really like the teacher or whatever? But, you know, we get a lot of freedom. I think that's one of the things I love about teaching is I get to kind of decide what I teach and how I teach it. I mean, there's like a state core or a common core that the whole, you know, these are kinds of things that we should teach them.
Here's objectives they need to hit,
like
right?
how to, you know, research and how to write argumentatively and things like that.
So it's more of an overarching theme than it is a specific topic.
Yeah. So I get to decide, okay, how am I going to teach them argument? So I get to find things that like relate to their lives. And like, here's an argument for why The Office is the greatest show. We're going to read this and we're going to watch this clip from The Office and make an argument and stuff like that. Cool. So then it's like, okay, this is cool. I can sit and talk about argument because we're talking about The Office or we're talking about whatever show, you know, is hot at that time. So
yeah, I love that.
But yeah, I think it's a really hard job to be a teacher. It's an important job. I really am proud of it. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not as intimidated as I used to be when I was younger.
So when you think about it, starting 12 years ago, you know, you had some of these younger students, you were new. Have you seen an evolution in the students? Are they different now than they were 12 years ago as far as paying attention, the way that they study, you know, their, you know, just the engagement, maybe the topics they're interested in. Have you seen a difference in them or are they pretty much the same?
Oh man, that's hard. It's hard. I've been thinking about this. Like, you know, we talk a lot about this generation, whatever it is. What do we call them?
Centennials.
Yeah. Centennials, millennials. And, you know, we know that they're on their phones all the time.
Right.
We know that social media is a big part of their lives. And I see that, you know, every day, these kids, you know, and it's one of those things that you can reject it and be like, you know what, I need to keep these kids off their phones and they no phones. And I just embrace it.
Sure.
And I'm like, you know what, they're going to be able to have their phone. And because these kids, man, they need it. It's one of those things where it's like air, you know, it's like water and they need to have it. And if they don't have it, they're not listening to you. They're not focused on you, or they're just finding ways to like sneak it under the desk and, you know, like you can't see. So it's like, you know, you just, and every teacher kind of has their own policy, but it's funny how it used to be 10 years ago where it was like, hey, no phones. And it was like school-wide policies and they've gotten rid of that because they can't enforce it. They really can't enforce it. And so
like everybody's expelled.
Yeah, exactly.
We're closing the school.
You just can't do it. And so you have to, it's funny how it happens where it's just kind of been this slow evolution and you know, you use it, you find ways, okay, well, I'm going to use your phone and we're going to do things in class where you're going to vote and you're going to send things in and you're going to type in instead of raising your hand and talking, which some kids just can't do, you know, you're going to send it in and you're going to type in
like a poll ad deal. Right?
Yeah, exactly. You're going to send in your thoughts and then we're going to put it up on the projector.
That's awesome.
And it allows kids to maybe participate. And sometimes I think, well, gosh, am I enabling these kids because I'm making them, you know, their whole life's online. And here I am making the classroom online. But I think it's so important that you have to meet these kids where they are.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just be like, well, I'm going to change everybody to be the way that I am. It's like, you got to figure out where they are and you got to meet them.
Right.
You know? And so if they're all addicted to their phones and they all, you know, and I'm just as bad as they are, but, you know, you gotta kind of use that and you want to be aware of it and be, you don't want to just totally enable everything, but you know, you still use that as a kind of, we're going to have this conversation this way. Now turn and talk to your neighbor and, you know, let's talk face to face with somebody and see if, you know, work it out or whatever. So,
how do you feel the dynamic has changed over the last 12 years, at least that you've been teaching? I look at, you know, school when we were back in school and it was kind of, you know, we didn't have a lot of those. Like I remember rocking the pager for the first time, like our senior year. And it was like, oh, 911 me, man, you know, kind of deal. And so we'd cut class a lot and we were kind of out playing, you know, like ultimate frisbee and just, you know, stuff like going to somebody's house, playing video games and so on. But I see a much different landscape in schools today. You know, the way kids interact, you know, if they're is interested in a lot of the things we were, it was all about sports and athletics and fun, you know, after, you know, extracurricular activities and so on. Do you still see that same level of engagement?
It's hard because we're, you know, we're turning into these old farts that are like, why don't you just go outside and play? You know, and it's like, it's still fun to stay inside and watch a movie too, you know? So like, I like to do
as
that.
As we're watching a movie, get outside.
Get outside and play.
I did my time.
But, you know, I think these kids, you know, they do struggle to talk to each other. And I don't know how that was when I was a kid. I mean, I know I was socially awkward when I was younger. And so I don't know how different it is or it was back then.
Sure.
But that's something that I'm trying not to generalize too much, but I do see that where I have to make a concerted effort to be like, hey, we're going to put our phones down. We're going to talk to each other. I'm going to teach them like, hey, turn, like I even teach them like small talk, like, hey, when you're done talking about the question that I just put up here that was related to our class, you know, afterwards, you can't just be like, hey, we're done. You got to keep talking for 4 minutes. So you got to be like, all right, so it's crazy weather we've been having. You know, I make jokes about it, but I'm like, you got to pretend to talk about, you know, those gas prices sure do get high. Right. Or whatever, you know. So like you got to kind of teach these kids to talk to each other, and you got to build a community. Like they have this community. It's crazy how many kids are friends on social media, but they're not friends in real life.
That's crazy.
You know, and I have people like that too. Like they might follow me on Twitter or something like that, but they don't, when I pass them in the hall, they don't go, "Hey, Mr. Nelson." They just walk right by, but then they like my tweet or whatever.
Yeah, and it's weird. Like that too.
Yeah, I am too. And it's hard. Like I feel like I can be friends with you online,
yeah.
But then friends with you in real life, what does that look like?
And that's a very interesting and unique take on some of these young people being connected that are classmates,
yeah,
connected online. But then when you see each other in the lunchroom, you don't talk.
And it doesn't happen like we think that, and maybe in a workspace it'd be similar. It doesn't just happen automatically. Like I think there are things as a teacher I need to do to create a community in my classroom.
Yeah.
They're little, that's why you always have get to know you games. And usually that's something that, you know, on the first day of school, you have some sort of get to know you activity, or you have some sort of like, you know, get up and tell everybody your name and what junior high you went to and one thing you like to do or one thing interesting about yourself, which I freaking hate. And everybody hates it. You know, everybody hates that. So it's like, you put me on the spot, making me try to pretend like I'm interesting and I'm not. But what's funny is in a lot of classrooms, you do that on the first day and then that's it. And then you just, okay, all right, day two, here we go. Let's talk about the quadratic formula. And then you wonder why kids don't talk to each other or they don't engage with each other in meaningful ways. And so I think one thing I do in my classroom is really, I don't just do that on the first day. Like I do lots of things where I try to get them into different groups and, you know, help them to get to know each other and like, you know, ask, come up with questions and interview questions and just things to get to know them on a personal level. So that then when I ask them to share their writing with each other or, you know, discuss this question or whatever, or this thing that happened in this book, they're more willing to do that because they feel like they know the person that's sitting next to them a little bit more.
So I have such a reverence for teachers, man. I'll tell you, some of the greatest teachers I have had in my life, I reference them all the time when I speak, when I talk to people. And I mean, Miss Cash, if you remember Miss Cash, I tell the story all the time. The only reason Carl has a diploma is because of Miss Cash. And it was after I was long gone from Taylorsville and I connected with her and she said, "Carl, I'm going to take care of you. You come and tutor at summer school and I'll help you get your diploma." And I love that lady, Elizabeth Cash, shout out, Magna. You know, but there's some people that have just been so influential in my life, and a lot of them are teachers. What do you think is the challenge of getting teachers the pay that they need, the tools that they need? I mean, this is always a big debate. You know, you have people saying, "Oh, we give so much money to the schools and the education system." And other people are going, "No, you don't. I need more money and we need more tools and resources." And I know in our own neighborhood, there are teachers that spend so much money out of their own pocket, bringing stuff to, you know, to school to educate our kids and help. And I'm of a very unique mindset. I believe that teachers, I think police officers, firefighters, I think all of them should get way more money than they do. And a lot of these corporate, you know, publicly traded companies, or, you know, or the public versus the private sector. I think a lot of the private, I mean, we get tons of money. I look at me and making tons of money and, you know, great, great success in my career. But I think, gosh, I don't deserve what I have compared to when I was a firefighter thinking, gosh, I'm looking around some of these brothers and sisters I'm working with thinking they're laying their life on the line.
Yeah.
You're responsible for my children. I've got six children that I love and adore and would do anything for. How can I get you the resources to give you every opportunity to have them succeed? I've been talking to Marley. I'm like, "Well, I'll tell you what, either Kyle's coming to Brighton or you're going to Lone Peak. one of the two, we're going to make this thing happen because I trust him. And I think this is a guy that will really take my child's, you know, education and prepare the youth for the future of the world and take it dead serious and give his everything to do it. Cause I know that that's the kind of person you are. What's lacking and what kind of gap do we need to fill to get to the ideal educational scenario for this younger generation getting into the real world and the workforce?"
I probably have weird views on this because, you know, I think the first thing, let's just talk turkey. I started teaching at $30,000 a year, $30,000, which is pretty low. You know, that's a pretty low amount. I think you can go in Wyoming and make like 45 out of the gate.
I always tell people my first management job, I was paid 26 grand a year. And when I was a front office manager at the Radisson, and I thought, I'm balling.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's weird because, you know, it was 30,000, but when I was working at Utah Power before, and that's a corporate job where I've worked there for years and I had opportunities to move up. And at one point I was making over 50,000 there and potentially could easily make over 100,000.
Absolutely.
And here I am now, you know, moved to become a teacher, and you're looking at the pay scale and you're thinking, crap, what am I doing? And, you know, 30,000 a year to begin is just, really tough to live on.
Yeah.
I have two kids.
With a family? Yeah.
Two kids, had a third kid my second year teaching. And so it was really rough at the beginning. My wife was staying home taking care of the kids, and it was just really tough to make ends meet. However, so where my views are a little bit weird is that I don't know if we necessarily need to pay teachers. I think we need to pay teachers a little more out of the gate. I think their beginning wage needs to be higher.
So the threshold's a little bit low at the beginning.
Yeah. And I'm happy now. I feel like pretty comfortable. I mean, I know my kids think we're poor, but I think we're pretty good. You know, I think, but granted, I've been teaching for 11 years and I have my master's degree plus additional education, which increases your pay. Like you get paid more based on how long you work and your education, just regardless of it, just your pay goes up.
Got it.
Related to those things. So, you know, I just, when you think about, okay, let's just throw more money into the education system. The problem is some of that money gets mismanaged. It goes to a district and then the district puts it here, there.
Allocates it inappropriately.
Yeah, it doesn't always, and not that people are mismanaging it necessarily. It's just not all of that goes to teachers, you know, it goes to other things, which we need still. And I'll just be honest. I just feel like I'm happy the way education is. Where my weird view comes in is if you just said, okay, well, let's start teachers out at 100 grand and let's, you know, I don't know where that money would come from, but let's start teachers out at 100 grand and then, you know, you could make up to, you know, 300 grand after you've taught for 20 years or whatever. And
right.
It's like, I just think you get the wrong type of people in there becoming teachers. Like, oh, I want to become a teacher. And like, they are not in it for the right reasons. They don't care about kids. They don't care about, you know, whatever subject it is that they're going to teach. And so I think the way it is, it's this weird balance where you almost want people there that you
want to
be there. Clear. They're not there for the money.
Yeah.
They're there for the kids. They're there for the content and you know,
it's almost a unique screening system.
It is. But at the same time, I mean, it sucks how many people you get that are qualified teachers that just have to leave because after like 2 years, I mean, I don't know what the statistics are, but you just get so many teachers that quit within their first 5 years. And it's really? Like, I just can't do it. I'm doing this. I'm working two jobs in the summer. And I got a part-time job during the school year. And not only is it's not enough money, but it's making it, I can't love teaching if I'm teaching for 8 hours and then I have to go to Home Depot and work for a 5 hour shift after work. You know, I'm going to be a crappy teacher.
Sure.
I'm going to be, you know, frustrated with the kids. I'm not going to have time to do anything with their work that they turn in or anything like that. And so, you know, at the same time that I'm saying don't give more money, it's like, we have to do something where we can retain those teachers that are qualified and get like the, you know, how many people that you think are really good at something and they're like, man, I just want to go into teaching. Like, that doesn't happen. It's like, usually you're really good at something.
So I'm going to pass up on this NFL contract because I want to go teach elementary school at Brookwood.
Yeah, it just doesn't happen. You know, and it, like math is the biggest, you know, math and science are the big ones where it's like, if you're really good at math or science, there are other things you can go do to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, if you're talented in that area.
I think so, anything STEM, right? Those are the big.
Yeah. So how do you get those qualified candidates that are really good at their subject, but then want to give back and teach the next generation?
I think you're right. It's a passion. It's something somebody wants to do. And shout out to my brother-in-law, Nathan Gordon, Ashley's husband, just got hired with Benyon Junior High, and he's going to be in his first year of teaching out there. So he's been working a long time toward getting that edumacation out at Westminster to get in there. So I'm proud of him and excited for his kind of his journey. I want to turn the page a little bit and talk a little bit about your coaching aspect. Obviously, you were able to get in and start coaching football and, you know, be part of the athletic programs out at Lone Peak. I love sports. I love sports to use in analogies. I love to look at sports and metaphors. Sports are just so competitive. And I love to relate them to business because you're part of a team. Mm. You're all going after goals. You're individual contributors. You're team contributors. You've got leaders and managers that have to inspire you and give you correct direction. And it's really, I just love sports. So when you look at that, what would you say, you know, when you're having to teach these young people, these centennials per se, what do you think is really, have you noticed maybe a key to success of motivating them, inspiring them, getting them bought in toward a goal? I mean, you guys are, how many championships do you have now?
Two.
Two championships. That's awesome. I mean, that is incredible for a high school. Taylorsville, I think, still was zero.
Hey, they played for one, though.
That is true. They lost, did. It was after us. But still, they played for one, which is good. Cottonwood's on that same boat. No, my other alma mater, post kicked out. But, you know, two championships, that's pretty incredible. But how do you inspire and motivate these young people, get them aligned? You know, you got the talent base, and how do you attract talent? And that whole business world shoved into a high school football team. What have you seen that's worked and not worked and, you know, coaching carousels and people moving around and trying to retain the same, you know, engagement? How's that all worked for you? And what have you noticed and learned from being a high school football coach?
Okay. You know, talent, first of all, talent is something that's out of our control, like, for the most part. I mean, we're not going around to other schools and be like, oh, this kid looks good. Will you come play for us? Like, that doesn't happen.
Shout out to Skyline Coach Dupe.
That might happen at other schools, but it doesn't happen where I come from. But so, you know, you get talented if you have teams that are talented, years that are talented, and you have years that aren't as talented. But it's funny how that doesn't always equate to success. You can have a lot of talent where kids just don't buy into the team and don't work hard or whatever, and it doesn't always equate. We've had super talented teams that lost in the first round of the playoffs or whatever. And, you know, and so there are lots of other factors, but I agree with you. I think that sports, it's like the perfect metaphor.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the whole thing, being a part of a team, you know, dealing with adversity.
Yeah.
And how am I going to get better? And, it, you know, it's so much more than just whatever ends up happening if you win or if you don't win. Like, that's, to me, is such a, it doesn't matter. You know, it's the life lessons that you get out of it. That's why I continue to coach and give up. You know, it takes a lot of time to coach, time away from my family. That's why I do it, is to be part of this. I want to be part of that team too.
Right.
You know, and it's not about, you know, winning or anything like that. It's just about those lessons that you can instill in these boys. And, you know, I love trying to sell them on that and getting them to reject their own ego a little bit, because we all have that. We all want to be great. We all want to play. We all want to be the starting quarterback. We all want to be, you know, whatever it is, but you can't. And in football, I think it's the perfect metaphor, because it's so many people. You have so many people that are part of it. In basketball, you only have five that can be on the court at one time.
Right.
You know, and you have 12 maybe that are on a team. In football, you can have anywhere. We have, you know, 85 or whatever. Yeah. So you have 85 personalities. How are we all going to work together for this common goal?
Yeah.
And, you know, all these different personalities and things like that. And so I do love that. And one of the things that, just for me personally, you know, how do I get kids to buy into that?
Right.
You know, you have to tell them, you have to talk to them about it. You have to get to know them and see where they're coming from. You have to, you know, I have to make practice meaningful for them.
Right.
It doesn't always work. You'll get some kids that if you just give them some mindless thing to do, some boring drill, and like, we're going to do this every day for some kids that works. And like, you think about the way coaching used to be back in the day,
yeah,
where, you know, Bear Bryant for Alabama wasn't coming up with like fun little drills. You know, he was just like, let's go again,
let's grind,
do it again,
grind.
You know, and there's an aspect to that, which I think is true in all of life. Sometimes it's going to be boring. It can't all be fun. But at the same time, and maybe this is a generational thing, maybe this is me personally, because I think that was something that always resonated with me, is when I find myself doing a job where I find this is meaningless.
Yeah.
I don't find any meaning in this. I'm not just going to do it just to do it. I feel like that's one of the things that maybe has changed with, you know, as generations change as well. So I need to find ways to, like, I have to tell them why. This is why we're doing this. Okay, we're doing this drill because this is the footwork that we're doing, and this is going to work on this route or whatever.
So they're heavily invested into the why of what they're doing.
Definitely. Definitely. I love that. And I think you have to, you know, remind them of that. The drill always goes better when it's like, if I have them do something and then it just is kind of disconnected, or it's like in a vacuum or something, they're not even really into it or anything. And then all of a sudden, you explain, okay, no, just pretend like you're coming across the middle, okay, and then this guy's going to stand right in front of you, and then you have to catch it while he tries to hit you. Oh, okay. And then it feels a little more real, and it's like, okay, yeah, I see why we're doing this. And then you add like an element of competition to it,
yeah,
which then you can get more out of people when you make them compete with each other. And, you know, just finding different ways to, you know, be able to pay attention, like, is this working? Is this not working? If it's not working, let's add something to it. Okay, now we're playing for money. Okay,
yeah,
whatever. You know, we don't actually play for money.
It's like
we play for
Lone Peaks on the radar.
We play for up downs. You know, I always say playing for money, but we're playing for up downs, or whoever loses, you have to run around the field five times or whatever.
Sure.
So then it's like, okay, we're going to make this matter right now.
So you've got a great father, Jeff, who we love, been my coach, and I love coach. Shout out to Jeff Nelson. Do you think you learned any good coaching skills or any techniques or anything, even things that you wanted to change based on him coaching you through all the years? Because I think I look at my dad and he coached me in soccer, coached me in basketball. And I think there's a lot of techniques that I coach my children now in sports. And I coach Kai in soccer. And there's a lot of tools that I use out of my dad's playbook and a lot of the logic. Is there anything that you've taken into, you know, your coaching career that you've taken from your dad? And then also, does your dad still give you any critique or any kind of feedback?
Gosh.
I see him at the games in the stands.
Yes, he does. He does give me tons of feedback.
Shout out to Jeff.
He, you know, if you ever go to like, I'll go to a University of Utah football game with him, and it's just hearing him yell to the, what are you doing? Run the ball! And like, it's funny when we're there, but then it's like, he does that same thing. He'll come up to me after. He's like, well, how come you know, it's 3rd and 3 and you're just trying to run the clock out? Why'd you try to pass the ball right there? Why would you pass it? There was 2 minutes left. Why would you just run the ball? It's like, Dad, you know, I need to come over
he's
here.
He's like, get Malave in. Yeah. It's like, Malave, Dad.
We've gotten into it a few times. No, he's, you know, he was my coach in all my sports. And
right.
He's a big reason why I love sports and why, you know, the importance that I put on sports, and that it's, you know, it's more than just something you do for fun. It's something you can learn lessons. And, you know, I think of being in 8th grade and having to go to football practice when I had friends that didn't have to go to football practice, and how hard that was. Like, right. Oh, it's 95 degrees outside. I got to go to practice, and
right.
These guys are just playing, and I got to go. And just the things that taught me, you know, from a young age, is just working hard toward a goal, seeing if it works, if it doesn't work. You know, I learned a lot of that from my dad, and I learned a lot of things that, you know, to not do from my dad. And my dad will be the first to tell you, like, just in life and, you know, different things that he'll be like, the best role model I was for you was that I taught you all the things not to do. You
know? I was going
to
say, I know he'd say something
like
that.
I went to jail when you were in 9th grade so that you didn't have to go. You know, he took one for the team. And,
that's right.
You know, I'm joking, but it's true. And there were things that he did that he was really hard on me, and it didn't work. Some of the stuff that he did with me didn't work. I wasn't the personality that I remember. He would get up, and you remember Jeff Sorensen?
Oh, of course.
Dude, he like had me get up, and he's like, do it again. I'm like trying to get up there and tackle on this guy. I'm like, I can't do it.
Lewis is like this incredible freak athlete.
Dude, just like, boom, runs you over. He's like, do it again. I'm like, I can't do this. And like, just some of the stuff, like, you know, it doesn't always work. The same stuff, you know this with your kids. What works with this kid doesn't work with this kid.
Yeah.
You know, yelling at this kid doesn't work yelling at this kid. Yeah. And using logic with this kid doesn't work using logic with this kid. And it's funny how you have to figure out all the different personalities. And that's one of the things that I've really, as a coach, I still am learning every year, because you have new players. And so I'm like, hey, I got to figure this kid out. And it's hard because when, like, I have 14 receivers right now, like, how do I know, how do I get to know each of these kids individually?
I love that.
You know, and being able to, you know, push them in such a way that's, you know, not going to make them just hate everything. And, you know, some kids need that though. Some kids need, like, you know, I hated that coach, but man, he sure got the most out of me.
Right.
And that works for some kids, but other kids, it's like, you know what? This coach cares about me, and that's what's important. So how do I know with what each kid needs? And that's something you just have to trial and error. And you know, I've made some mistakes. I've had players that I did not get the most out of.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that this kid needed me to, and that did not work.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where we did not connect, and he wouldn't do anything for me.
You bring up a great point, and this is something that I've been preaching and preaching. I think I spoke about it on the last podcast with Elisa. It's all about individuality and understanding people on an individual level. And I think that's why I love sports. Exactly what you said is the future of business. I think it used to be you could throw a leadership blanket over everybody, and you just give everybody the same expectations, treat them exactly the same way. And they were expected to perform at the same level. And I even think of us when we were playing sports, it's kind of like, well, you just kind of suck it up, and, you know, it's coach said it, and he's going to yell at you and hit you over the helmet with his whistle, and it hurts, but just kind of the way you deal with it. And I think that's the old manufacturing way of doing business. Like, oh, you want to know how much I care about you? Check out that paycheck you get every 2 weeks in your bank account. Mm-hmm. That's how much I care about you. And it's like, well, you need to know me as an individual. So it's funny that you say that, because I think these centennials need that so much. I think even millennials need it more so than anybody's ever needed. I think our parents and our grandparents put up with a lot of guff just in the name of, it just comes with the territory.
Yeah.
And I think this younger generation's like, nah, man, I can't. They're not being defiant about it. You're exactly right. They're not responding to it. And you have to find that unique individuality, which takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of effort. It's, you know, it's like, oh, why can't you be like Sorensen? You know, which I'll tell you on a side note, that was the most brutal part of my junior high experience, was being by Lindsay Soja, Jeff Sorensen, Carl Sokia, all lockered by each other, all these athletes, and then like this random Carl kid. Brutal. So it's like everybody's locker was all decorated except for Carl's, the manager of the volleyball team.
That's funny.
But I mean, you look at those kind of things, and I think you're exactly right. It's all about knowing people as an individual and being able to utilize their talents and just tap into their why and just try to drive that through. Have you seen the relationships with you and players or other coaches and players really evolve into something very, very unique and very special? And the reason I ask that is, you know, we just had Matt Martinez on here, and I also brought in Tango Towns, both University of Utah football players. One of the things is we were talking about different things, whether it be, you know, Tango talking about where he came from and coming to Utah and the experience, all the way down to Matt and kind of his evolution from not only high school football and being very competitive with Cottonwood up through the University of Utah experience, but then into business and being very successful. But I, both of them referenced coaches and said, oh, you know, and I loved Matt. Matt was talking about Kalani Sitake and just how much he loves him. And, you know, there's a big rivalry between, you know, Utah and BYU. And I've watched all these Utah players just say, hey, listen, I know the rivalry's there and we were, but we love Kalani because he was crying with me. He was laughing with me. He was such an incredible man in my life. Do you see that kind of bond with your, you know, with your players when they're going through tough times? Because I think there's a lot of young people that are just trying to figure life out, right? And a lot of times they can't go to their parents. And so I would say it takes a village to raise these kids. Mm-hmm. And you're part of that village now, right? Do you see you creating an influence that maybe outside people aren't able to create? Maybe the parents or so on, because that's who I depend on is people in my neighborhood and people that are in their ancillary activities. I'm going, hey, I need you to tap into my kid and right. I need you to help them when they need a, you know, somebody to hang on to because they ain't listening to me. You know, as much as I'd love them to. Do you see that really evolving in your space?
Yeah. And, you know, it applies to me both. it applies to me both in the classroom and on the field.
I love that.
And probably, you know, it's funny because I'll see some of these kids that I'll have in football and I'll have them in my class too. And so you have this, you get to see kind of two different sides of them. And, you know, I would say that, you know, you, for me personally, I have more impact on the people in my classroom than I do on the field, which is, It's funny because it's just a different dynamic. And I know I still have a strong influence on the kids on the football team, but you don't know, you don't learn everything that's going on in their lives in the same way that you do for me in the classroom.
Right.
I'm reading their journals that they turn in, and, you know, things like that. And you're finding out things that like, you're like, holy cow, I can't believe all the stuff that these guys are going through.
They're giving you a peek behind the curtain into their life. Man,
yeah. And it's something I've really learned as in my role is that I can't, you know, you don't ever know what's going on in somebody's life. And so you just, it's allowed me to have so much more patience. And when a kid puts his head down in my class, you know, I used to be like, what are you doing? Like, I'd take that personally. Like, you know, you hate me, you're bored at this class or whatever. And I've evolved and it's like, there are other things. Like, who knows? He could be up all night, you know, his parents are fighting, you know,
or, formed your empathy,
you
right?
know? Yeah. Like he had to work till 3 a.m. last night, you know, or whatever, like all these things that are so that you don't know what's going on. And so I give kids the benefit of the doubt so much more. And on an outsider, you might look at someone like me, like I'm not a total jerk in my class. And you might think, well, I just let kids get away with anything. And maybe I'm a total enabler. I don't look at it that way. You know, I think that I give these kids a safe place where, you know, they're not going to be yelled at all the time and they're going to have somebody who cares about them. And for the most part, gives them the benefit of the doubt. I'm still going to push them and I'm still going to challenge them on things. But, you know, I'm coming from a place where I know that I don't know everything that's going on with you.
Right.
And when I do find out those things, you know, what a unique, you know, opportunity to give them, you know, advice or just tell them like, you know, keep going and just like keep plugging along, you know, it's going to get better or whatever. And when they can hear that, it doesn't even have to be that eloquent, whatever I say.
Like, yeah.
If they can just hear that from someone else, it's funny how you start to tune out your parents and you're just like, dude, I've heard this from my mom and my dad over and over again. I don't,
totally.
As soon as I hear it from another person, it doesn't even matter who that is, another adult, another, you know, whatever. Then it's like all of a sudden it clicks and it's like, oh, okay.
That's what I would say is it takes the right person at the right time. Mm-hmm, yeah. I love that. If you have advice for employers or people that are taking over, maybe even, I guess employers and organizations that are welcoming these people into the workforce, into the real world, into their lives, what advice would you have for them? I mean, we've talked about a couple of things with individuality and treating them as an individual, you know, kind of their communication style. What would you say are maybe two or three overarching themes that you would give as feedback or recommendations on just your perception of what's going to help set them up for success and how we need to kind of bend as employers or organizations or as this quote unquote real world of work, what's going to help set them up for success that we need a dramatic change in?
Well, I'm thinking of it in terms of, you know, because you have like maybe how do I get a team to work well together? Like that's one way to look at it. And I think there are some things that you can do to make a team work well. But if you're just looking at maybe individuals and how do I get the most out of this employee or whatever, I think like what you said is true. You know, being able to, like I said earlier, meet them where they are, figure out where they're coming from, you know, get to know them. I always have a introductory survey that they fill out at the beginning of the year where it's just like, I have all these questions like, well, tell me about your class last year and tell me about some things you like to do. And just, and I'm always trying to kind of get feedback from them. And I'll do a lot of times where it's on a, you know, every, when they turn in an assignment, I have a question at the end that says anything else.
Yeah.
And that means, you know, anything else that you want to say,
like open-ended.
Tell me, you know, whatever. And so I'll get people to say things like, you know, hey,
Harold Biner's the best NBA player ever.
He really is.
I had to sneak that in.
He really is. You know, my pen name, you know, I used to be Ghostwriter.
Yeah.
Guess what it is now?
Harold Biner 32.
Harold Biner. That's Harold my Biner. Pen name. So whenever we write, we do stuff online, like in my class where we post our writing and then we have little pen names. Mine's Harold Miner. So
I love it.
You say Harold Miner to my students, they know exactly who that is. I got my little starting lineup, Harold Miner. For those who don't know, Harold Miner was a slam dunk.
Oh, don't worry. Everybody knows.
Oh, I'm sure. Okay, Google him. He was supposed to be the next Jordan, baby Jordan. Give this man his accolades. He got drafted by the Miami Heat. He was going to be the greatest. He was going to be the next Jordan. He stuck his tongue out, everything, just like Jordan.
And baby Jordan.
He got like 10 minutes a game, never really got a chance. Ended up, you know, 3-4 years in the league, and then he was out, had a knee injury, and never really lived up to his potential. And man, I'm telling you, it used to be like I just loved Harold Miner, but then now it's become like this. It's this like thing in my life with like failed potential. Like here I am in a place where I deal with all these young people that could do anything with their lives.
Yeah.
I have all these like baby Jordans.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, in different fields, and it's like it sucks. I'm trying, you know, I love Harold Miner, but I'm trying not to. Turn them into Harold Miner.
That's,
you know, it's
right.
My job is to like get the most out of them. And although I think I've read some stuff and Harold Miner's happy now, I think so. It's not all about basketball, but if you have a certain gift and talent, you got to get the most out of them. But
shout out to Harold Miner. I'm sure he listens to the podcast.
I know.
He has to.
Harold,
but I'll tell you what, I blame that on Miami. I think this is pre Pat Riley.
It is. It's Kevin Lowry. He's the coach. Never played him. Okay, gave him 10 minutes a game. You get 10 minutes, he scored 12 points.
We're not a fan of you, Kevin Lowry.
10 minutes, 12 points. You got to give that guy more minutes.
That's right.
Okay, and you guys all have people on your teams this way too. You know. Anyway,
I love it. I promised Kyle we're gonna sneak in sneak in Harold Miner reference, and he didn't think I was gonna do it, and I got him.
Yeah.
So,
The other part of your question, I mean, the other thing I wanted to say was just, I think most people want to do like good work. I think they want to work hard. They want to get meaning out of their job. And I think that whether you know, I'm thinking of myself when I worked at Utah Power and I had a couple of bosses there.
Yeah.
And I think when they talked with me, they figured out that, okay, this isn't what I was going to do for my whole life. Like,
sure.
You know, do I have somebody here that's just is this going to be their career and like they're a lifelong employee with this company, or are they kind of working on something else and this is just something that they're going to be doing for the next 2 years?
Sure.
And I think it's important as a boss to know that, like know where your employees are and kind of what they think and what they want out of their job. And you can still get a lot out of your employee that only wants to be there for 2 years,
right,
and has other dreams and is working on a degree to go do something else.
Right.
You can still get them to put in meaningful work. And I think I had a couple of bosses that did that with me, and I remember having these types of conversations where you would, like, what do you want to do? Like, what, okay, you're going to school. How's that going? What are you studying? And they got to know me and they knew that like I was going to become a teacher. I was going to leave and go do something else, but I was still going to be here for the next couple of years as I finished.
Right.
And they were still able to get the most out of me. So knowing where your employees are coming from, and trusting that, you know what, they want to do good work. Like I'll have students that will be in my class that are like, you get different labels of, you know, have a learning disability or they have, sure, behavior problems or whatever. And, you know, I've had like co-taught classes where you have like a special ed teacher that's, oh, in, sure, the room with them. And
while you're teaching.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, like you can have kids get a label. And I've found that, you know, if you give kids the benefit of the doubt and you trust that they want to, you know, and I'm thinking more behaviorally,
right, because
sometimes there are learning things that are like, it's not a matter of will. It's just a matter of skill. Like I can't do it.
Right.
But when you've got kids that maybe aren't buying into things, you can sell them and you can get them on board. If you kind of give them the benefit of the doubt and like believe that they want to do good work and you almost like you give them a couple of little victories. You know, you help kids start to feel like, you know what?
Give them a nudge.
Like for real, let me just tell you. My sister, when I was younger, she told me, she's like, Kyle, you're such a good vacuumer. You're the best at vacuuming. So will you just vacuum? And I know she's a sucker. Like I'm a sucker. She
Tony, just... Tony Macaluso, are you vacuuming the house? Listen up. You're not a good vacuumer. Cammy's manipulating you.
But it's like, if you can get somebody that tells you that you're good at something, and like, I remember thinking, I took this pride and like, I am a good vacuumer.
Yeah.
Like I do these lines and like the lines are there and I get all the way to the edge. I'm so freaking good at vacuuming. And I know she was just like tricking me, but if you can get your kids, like I'll have a kid write something and he'll turn it in. And it was like, it's so bad. You know, it's just the grammar, it misspelled everything. Nothing is right. And it's just like, it's so bad. There's so many things wrong with it. I can find something in there to be like, you know what? This was actually really cool.
Yeah.
You know, you highlight this one part and I'm not lying. I'm not blowing smoke.
Right.
You know, I'm still telling them like, here's something that you can build off of.
Yeah.
And if you can give people that, it's amazing how they can start to look at themselves. I've had kids that like come into my class and they do not look at themselves as a reader or as a writer or as a thinker or as a communicator. Yeah. All of these different things, the skills that I want them to get in my class, they don't look at themselves that way. But when they start to either have me see that in them or have their peers see that in them,
yeah,
man, they start to, and maybe that's partly because I'm, you know, they're at such a formidable age.
Well, I think it's you care. You're looking for an opportunity for potential.
Yeah.
You know, even a unique potential. It's, I don't know if you listen to the podcast, and I remember which episode it's on, but I actually referenced this. There's a post from the Humans of New York where this young man talks in France, talks about the teacher. Have you heard this yet?
Yeah.
And it's the same exact concept you're talking about where he, you know, this teacher had asked the student to stay after class and he thought, oh, I'm in deep trouble. He's going to critique me. And instead he said, This is great. This is a great starting point. And then I said, you know, now I read. I had dyslexia, but now I read, you know, 4 or 5 books a day, or I mean a week or whatever it is. And I see, I keep sending these reports. And this is way after this teacher's long gone, because you really set the tone for that.
Yeah.
My last question for you is just in regard to parenting. You know, when you look at, you know, you're dealing with a lot of these youth for probably more hours than their families are, you know, whether it be in the classroom, on the field, or whatever it may be. What advice do you have for parents? And what do you think that you can impart on really helping them to, you know, understand their kids, the unique ability of them learning and so on? Because a lot of us don't have, there's no parent coaching training, right? It's, we're just winging it, thinking we know our kids. And I think you get to see a, you know, a totally different angle. I'll tell you, when I see some of my kids' homework and some of the poetry they write and so on, it gives you such an intel. We're like, I had no clue. You know what I mean? And I think, you know, what advice would you have for parents in that realm? Because I think, I look at your parenting situation and your parents going through a divorce, you know, initially, and you and Cammy both turned out incredibly. And I think you had such an incredible stepdad and Corey, and you know, the whole dynamic worked out so well with your parents. And I love your parents. They're phenomenal. Your mom making you breakfast every morning. And I always envied that. I was like, well, Kyle's mom makes some sandwiches to go to lunch.
Don't eat carameled apples.
I know, carameled apples. That's right. And you know, come stay at the house and play Nintendo. But I mean, you just had such loving parents. I mean, loving, loving parents that I think really set you up for success and did a lot of great things. And that's not always the case, especially when a divorce comes into play. I had one of my close friends that I grew up with that we were actually talking just a few. We went to elementary school together and kindergarten and so on. We were having a discussion and he said, you know, Carl, I really love, you know, reading your posts and stuff about your family because it's exciting. And I said, yeah, man, tell me what's going on. And he said, you know, this is weird to say now. And he said, but it all fell off. It all fell off the hinges when my parents got divorced. Mm-hmm. And he goes, I now as a 40-year-old man realize that looking back, because that's where I started to kind of act out and change and so on. But I think you were a part of a, you know, a very unique situation where you had a lot of success. And I'm sure it still wasn't easy, but you were able to have a lot of success through that. And I know there's so many young people going through challenges similar to that could totally derail their life, derail everything that they do. And parents just don't know how to deal with it. They don't know exactly what to do. And you get to see them at a very vulnerable stage where they're sharing poetry and journal entries and so on. What is maybe some unique wisdom you can impart upon those people?
Yeah. So I got two thoughts on that. The first one is, you know, get your kids to try out a bunch of different things. And I'm not sure if this is where you're going with your question, but this is what popped into my head was you never know what you're good at. You never know what is going to like flip the switch of like, this is what I'm passionate about. And so if you can get your kids to try out different things, try out different sports, try out different extracurricular things, like that's the thing that I've seen the most in my, you know, seeing all these different students is that the ones who are trying out different things and they're taking different classes, different extra classes, elective classes, and then that those are the ones that like figure out, okay, this is, you may not figure it out in high school.
Sure.
But you know, you're going to continue to have that mindset of like, I'm going to experiment and try out different things. And then, this is the thing that like I want to do for the rest of my life.
And it almost makes it okay for them to try and fail. Mm-hmm. And I love that you give that as an example, because I look at my, you know, me and you know, in high school and right out of high school, I probably had 150 jobs between the ages of 15 to 20. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah.
And but a lot of us dabbling.
Some people look at that as a bad thing. You know?
I loved it because I gained so much experience.
Great experience.
Ooh, a little, you know, I had 6 months here, 3 months there, folding jeans in the back of a Gap, you know, being a credit card salesman, you know, for a telemarketing company. But I just gained little nuggets of all this wisdom. And it also, I reference back to a lot of it. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I'm working in hospitality, food and beverage. I'm like, hey, listen, I don't know exactly what you do, but I worked at Chili's for 2 years. And mm-hmm. I'll tell you what, some of the things that I take away that I understand about your role. And it was just a little nugget, but it was enough to kind of say, that's something I never want to do again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, because we live like in this society that like, if I want to be great at something, like Tiger Woods started golfing when he was 3.
Right.
You know, I got to focus my whole, I can't talk to girls, I can't do anything, I got to just golf for the rest of my life, and then I'll win the Masters. And you probably will win the Masters if you do that. But, you know, I just think that you need to, you know, I said it took me 11 years to get my bachelor's. I took so many classes that I was terrible. I took classes I didn't even need to take. I didn't know you're supposed to talk to a counselor and like figure out like, oh, hey, these are the classes you're supposed to take. Like, I was just taking classes. Like, oh, the class looks good. I'm an idiot. Spending all this money. I'm still paying off my college because I took 475 credit hours, you know, or whatever.
Graphic design.
You know, I'm taking all these classes. But man, some of those experiences were so just invaluable. And is that the right word? Anyway.
Yeah, invaluable. That's right.
So the next.
I don't know. You're the English teacher.
I know. So the next thing is being able to articulate your experience. I think, and this is me being an English teacher, is like that word is something I try to like just drive in to my students, is like, I want to be able to articulate how I'm feeling. I want to be able to articulate this experience. I want to be able to articulate, you know, my argument on this topic. And that's what you're practicing when you're communicating, when you're writing and things like that, is you're practicing articulating what it is that's in your head. So many times you have something in your head or in your heart, like you talk about poetry, like how do I have this emotional experience. My parents got divorced. How do I write about that? You know, and not that that's the only thing that you can write about, but so often you have these strong emotions. How do I take those emotions that make sense in my brain and make sense in my head, or sometimes don't, but how do I make sense of them on paper or even in a conversation? Like right now I'm trying to articulate where I'm coming from and answering your questions. And it's not always easy. And I was going to bring, you know, we talk about our friend Trey and Trey,
love you, Trey.
Trey's
a listener of the show.
What's up, Trey? And, we wrote letters when he was in jail. And one of his letters, I wanted to bring it cause I wanted to read it exactly. Cause I've brought this up with my students before. And I just read this one little part of his letter. And he said something to the effect of, you know, what I needed to do better, what I didn't do was I wasn't able to talk about how I felt. You know, if you stepped on my shoes, you know, Trey, you step on his shoes, he just freaks out. And he wasn't able to like,
the arms shot right out.
Yeah.
Boom.
He wasn't able to like put on process and be like, hey, I am frustrated that you stepped on my shoes.
Yeah. Right.
Like he couldn't do that.
Yeah. That and whole that, process.
Yeah. And he talked about the, you know, we talk about, and this is something that's unique maybe to boys more so than girls. And maybe that's not right, but like boys aren't really taught to like, you know, process their feelings and like deal with what they're actually feeling. There's like, they just look.
I think Callahan talked about that on our last episode, on his last episode.
Definitely.
We've got to kind of, we're the fixers and we just charge ahead and emotions aren't built in our DNA.
Yeah. And so I'm in this unique position where I'm trying to get these, you know, students to write and write about their feelings sometimes and write about, you know, these different experiences they've had. And it's my boys, especially, that I really got to try to get them to buy into, what this all means. Cause they don't, you know, they're like for the first time, what are these wet things coming from my eyes? Like what? I don't know what's going on. Like those are tears. You're feeling something.
Yeah.
You know? Anyways.
Shout out to Bonesai.
Yeah, there you go. And like, you know, as a parent, here I am, I got two boys, you know, I'm trying to train, how do I teach these boys, you know, to be men.
Yeah.
I had them out chopping wood yesterday in the backyard.
Wow.
How do I get, you know, I want them to chop wood, but I also want them when they're fighting with each other, you know, to be able to just talk about it and not just throw punches.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's a hard thing to do because boys, that's not, That's not in our, I don't know if it's in our DNA or not, but it's not really taught to us. And right. I think that's something that's slowly, hopefully changing. But, you know, I'm one of them that's trying to change that with these boys. Like, how could I get Trey to talk about whatever it is? Because he came right out and said that that's why he's in jail.
Oh, no doubt.
You know, is that he couldn't process what he was going through. And it wasn't just that, you know, one incident. It was other things in his life that
built
up to that. And yeah. I have, how do I work
articulate
through these
that.
Things?
That's exactly, yeah. You're exactly right. And yeah. I agree with you 100%. Mm-hmm. Is you see some people have the silver tongue. Mm-hmm. And they can talk their way out of anything. And there's people that don't have that gift,
yeah.
which is so unfortunate, you know, especially with Trey. We love Trey. Trey's a listener to the show. He learned how to download a podcast a few weeks ago, and he's been loyal ever since.
I love it.
So, yeah, I love you, Trey. Okay, I know I said that was my last question, but I do have one more. You're a big reader.
Yep.
You love to read. What are you reading lately?
Oh, what am I reading? I read The Goldfinch just barely. That was way too long, 700 pages, just because the movie was coming out. So I was like, I got to read this book.
Sure.
And it was all right. I'm excited for the movie with Ansel Elgort, I think is his name.
I think so.
The guy from Fault in Our Stars. Anyway, yeah. I'm reading right now, what's it called? Hold on, I might have to get my Goodreads out real quick.
I love it. Get your Goodreads out. Get your Goodreads out, baby.
Dude, I love talking about books. Look at these books. I just want to say what Carl has all these like leadership books. Freakonomics, that's good. He's got all the Malcolm Gladwell stuff. He's got the Mamba Mentality. That's on my to-read list.
Yeah.
Brené Brown. I've been meaning to watch that on Netflix.
Yeah, she's good. Vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually really liking this book. I just can't think of what it's called. A Prayer for Owen Meany. Okay, this song is it's a book by John Irving, Prayer for Owen Meany. It's about a kid who his friend hits a foul ball and it kills his mom.
What?
It's crazy. It's just fiction, but it's it's just great story of this friendship and how that incident made him believe in God. It's called A Prayer for Owen Meany.
Wow.
Owen Meany's this little like 11-year-old, like super tiny, and he's the one that hit the foul ball that killed the narrator's mom. And it's like, how did he even hit this ball? He's never hit a ball in his whole life. And it's like, it was meant to be. He was the instrument that all of this. Anyway, it's very fascinating.
Wow.
I'm like halfway through it. I love it so
far. I'll check it out. Well, good. Well, thanks for the love on the book collection. That's just some of the books we gather because we love to edumacate ourselves in our minds when we don't have college degrees and get kicked out of two high schools. We just try to read some books and figure it out as we go.
There you go.
So anyway, Kyle Nelson, one of my best friends. Love you, brother. Thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate all the insight you've given. And to all of those who downloaded this episode of the podcast, you know how much I appreciate it. You know, we get a lot of great feedback from all of you. And thanks. And I hope you continue to tune in. I hope you found this episode valuable. Make sure you tell your friends and family members about the episode and help them to take away the same things you took away from the episode. Until next time, my friends, aloha!
Yeah!